basically the door's open, and that independent tire producers, entrepreneurs, developers, Alaska's open business now.
A new rule that makes it easier to sell power to the grid. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, commercial fishermen work to catch lamprey eels on their Yukon River run.
Some of them go to Europe, some of them go to Asia, and some of them go into the bait market.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A federal commission says the oil companies that own the Trans-Alaska Pipeline can't raise rates to cover cost overruns for an upgrade that went horribly over budget. The plan to upgrade four pump stations with electric motors was projected to cost $242 million and to be finished in 2005. Instead, it cost nearly three times that much and still isn't fully complete. The ruling by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is a victory for the state of Alaska, which can collect more tax on oil if the cost of transporting it is lower. It is an even bigger win for independent companies like Anadarko and Tesoro that use the pipeline but don't own a stake in it. The decision leaves BP, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon footing most of the bill. Since they're the majority owners of the pipeline, the Federal Commission says there's serious doubt they performed a reasonable cost-benefit analysis, so they can't raise rates to cover the cost of their bad decisions. A spokeswoman for Alyeska Pipeline did not reply in time for this story, but she told the Alaska Dispatch News one reason the project took so long was the decision to modernize the pump stations one at a time so they could learn as they went. Alaska and British Columbia today signed a memorandum of understanding giving the state a larger role in transboundary mine permitting decisions. Governor Bill Walker and BC Premier Christy Clark signed the document during a teleconference. Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott and BC Mining Minister Bill Bennett oversaw its development. Bennett says it's a framework covering permitting, water testing, transportation, and other transboundary issues.
It signifies and formalizes our commitment, Alaska and BC's commitment, to work more closely together, to put more effort into that collaboration, and to work on further agreements between the jurisdiction that will allow us to put in some detail exactly what that additional collaboration looks like.
He says the other agreements should be completed early next year. Walker issued a statement saying the memorandum could also boost economic development on both sides of the border. That includes improved transportation links and tourism promotion. Mine critics in Alaska have said such an agreement has no teeth. The document specifically says it imposes no legally binding obligation that could be enforced in court. Bennett and Malott say such provisions can only be part of a treaty between the federal governments of both nations. New rules could make it easier to develop more renewable energy in Alaska by making it easier for independent projects to sell their power to the grid. APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Mike Kraft has been trying to expand his wind farm near Delta Junction since 2010. In his view, the project is a win-win.
Create some jobs for my kids and friends and family and neighbors. I want to bring down the cost of power, and I want to do something about this air in Fairbanks.
But the local utility, the Golden Valley Electric Association, wouldn't buy his power. They said it was too expensive, even though it was likely cheaper than some of their existing sources.
I can compete with diesel, I can compete with natural gas, I can compete with... Coal's pretty tough. Coal's a bargain, no doubt about it. If you don't mind the consequences of burning it, it's a bargain.
But Kraft argued he shouldn't have to compete with the cheapest part of a utility's portfolio. He should only have to beat the price of whatever power his project would displace. In 2013, he filed a petition with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, which oversees utilities. This month, after 2 years of hearings, the commission issued new rules, and Kraft got his way. Under the old system, a wind farm or hydro project had to beat the average cost of a utility's power. That included everything from cheap coal to relatively expensive diesel. Under the new rules, if a wind project can produce electricity more cheaply than diesel, the utility has to buy that less expensive power. This brings Alaska into line with rules in the rest of the U.S., and Kraft calls it a game changer.
Basically, the door's open. And that independent power producers, entrepreneurs, developers are just a guy that has a house when he wants to put a wind turbine on his house. Alaska's open for business now.
Ethan Schutt of Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, or CIRI, has a more measured response.
It definitely, you know, could help a little, and sometimes just a little is all it takes to get something from concept to construction.
CIRI developed the Fire Island Wind Project. With 11 turbines, it can produce up to 17 megawatts for Chugach Electric, one of the main utilities in South Central. But CIRI scrapped a project to double the number of turbines when it couldn't find a buyer for the new power. Schutt says one big issue is integration. Sources like wind and solar are variable. When the wind isn't blowing, no electricity is produced. That means it's more complicated to integrate them into the grid than a traditional natural gas or coal plant. Utilities charge fees to cover that. And in the past, Schutt says, it wasn't clear how they came up with those costs.
In the absence of regulatory guidance, each utility was able to address those issues in its own self-serving way.
The new rules include a set of criteria that utilities must use in making those decisions. That doesn't mean the Fire Island expansion is coming back. For CIRI, there's still another major hurdle, transmission costs. If they want to sell to, say, Golden Valley in Fairbanks, right now they have to pay every other utility along the way. That can double the price of their electricity, and the new rules don't address that problem. But for Mike Kraft in Delta Junction, he says it's full steam ahead.
I'm excited. I feel like I have my life back in a sense, and I have my state back.
He says, "I'm going to finish building this wind farm." From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a committee in Wasilla decides the fate of a book some find offensive.
We had a really really kind of an inspiring discussion just because it was so open and honest.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The Alaska Supreme Court today upheld a lower court's ruling that a private air service violated campaign finance laws when it offered flights to two Lake and Peninsula Borough Assembly candidates in September of 2010. KDLG's Hannah Colton has more.
In 2011, the Alaska Public Offices Commission filed a complaint against Bush Plains LLC, the non-commercial air service owned by the multimillionaire anti-Pebble financier Bob Gillum. APOC said Gillum's firm made illegal corporate contributions when it offered airplane rides to Assembly candidates Nana Kalmakoff and Michelle Ravenmoon without charging them commercial fares. The candidates were invited to join in the September flights by former state legislator George Jacko, who Gillum had hired to be his, quote, eyes and ears in Bristol Bay. Jacko traveled through the Lake and Peninsula Borough on Bush Plains aircraft to advocate against the Pebble Mine. The air service argued that Kalmakoff and Ravenmoon were simply hitching a ride on the previously scheduled flights and that the candidates had paid their share of fuel costs. But APOC fined Bush Plains $25,500 plus an additional $30,000 in investigation and lawyers' fees. Gillum's firm appealed APOC's decision to a superior court, which upheld the decision and the penalty. In its ruling Wednesday, the Alaska Supreme Court affirmed the lower court's and APOC's decisions, saying that Bush Plains did violate state campaign finance laws. The court also ruled that the amount of the fine imposed by APOC was not unconstitutionally excessive. This wasn't Gillum's first run-in with APOC. In the spring of 2010, Gillum agreed to pay the commission $100,000 in a settlement related to a ballot measure and alleged violations in a years-long advertising campaign against Pebble. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Republicans in Alaska are suing in federal court to overturn the state's strict limits on donations to political candidates and groups. The suit challenges the state's $500 annual cap on individuals' donations to candidates and three other contribution limits. The briefs in the case rely on two recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings, including the 2010 Citizens United decision. Nathaniel Herz, a reporter with Alaska Dispatch News, filed a story on the lawsuit earlier this week. He says Alaska has some of the most restrictive contribution limits in the country.
It's definitely clear that Alaska's is, you know, among the lowest five states probably. And, you know, there's some states where the limits are like $5,000. There's some states where the limits are where there are no limits. I think the case that they're making is that, you know, the limits are so unreasonably low that they're, you know, I mean, maybe you're going to get to this, but that they're sort of unreasonable burden restricting free speech. And, you know, I think the Supreme Court has ruled in cases before sort of specifically striking down low limits, kind of like these ones. So
beyond the idea of the amount hasn't kept up with inflation, what else is the harm that you heard from the plaintiff's attorney, Kevin Clarkson? You spoke to him. What does he say the harm is with these limits?
Their central claim is that this is a restriction on free speech. I mean, I think the problem that they have is more practical, which is that they can't, you know, there are folks out there that want to, that, you know, that have money that they want to give to candidates and groups and to causes, and they can't, or they can't give as much as they want. And sort of they need to make a legal argument that that's not legitimate, and the one that they're mustering is a constitutional one.
You also, as part of your reporting on this, spoke to an attorney with a group called Common Cause that seeks to tighten campaign finance laws. He called the Alaska case dangerous. Why did he say that?
Well, you know, you've seen two cases now that the U.S. Supreme Court has decided that have really sort of undermined restrictions on money in politics that groups like this one view as important and beneficial to democracy. And, you know, the question is, what happens if they're invalidated, and what are the appropriate limits if there are limits at all? And, you know, if they're eliminated entirely, like has been done, at least when it comes to independent spending on the federal level, you know, what happens to the political landscape here? And I don't think that anyone is suggesting that Alaska's campaign contribution limits would be sort of entirely erased. You know, they haven't been erased on the federal level. They still exist. And, you know, they haven't been invalidated by the Supreme Court. But certainly, I think there's a fear that with sort of the attitude of the current U.S. Supreme Court and the majority on it, that you could see more rulings that have a similar impact on these laws and rules elsewhere around the country, or that further sort of change the regime at the federal level.
State Republicans are supporting the case. What about Democrats? You talked about one Democrat that you talked to, but what about other Democrats? Have you heard from them?
You know, there's been not a whole lot of discussion about this, you know, publicly. I reached out to the state Democratic Party, and, you know, initially when I talked to the party's executive director, she said she was not particularly up to speed, and they have ultimately got me a statement that said, you know, they're not fans of this. They do not want to see these limits undermined. But certainly, you know, it seems like so far it's kind of flown under the radar a little bit. I think certainly, based on the reactions I've gotten so far, it certainly seems like there's a lot less enthusiasm about changing these contribution limits from Democrats than from Republicans. And, you know, I had heard after I published the story, there was one Democratic legislator who wanted to remind folks that the Democrats have long been proponents of strict campaign finance rules. You know, and I do think that sort of you'll start to hear a lot more about it once this case moves towards trial, which is currently set preliminarily for April.
Nathaniel Herz is a reporter with Alaska Dispatch News. Wasilla City officials heard public testimony Monday night about a library book that is concerning some parents. The book, called This Book is Gay, was written by a UK author. James Dawson and some parents say it is not appropriate content for the library's young readers. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
When one mother noticed her 10-year-old with a copy of This Book is Gay in his hand, she was shocked. Vanessa Campbell says the book contained graphic sexual descriptions and has no place in the Wasilla Library's juvenile nonfiction section. This Book is Gay is written for young readers or any readers grappling with questions about homosexuality. Its tone is humorous and it contains cartoons, but some of the content explains sexual practices, and that is what concerns some Wasilla parents. Campbell complained to library director K.J. Martin Albright, but Martin Albright, after review, decided not to move the book to another library area. Campbell filed for reconsideration, a rarely used process to get a change in what section of the library the book will be shelved. David Cheesham, owner of Palmer's Fireside Books, is on the committee that will make that decision.
I was just asked, you know, as someone with a literary insight to take part in this ad hoc committee dealing with the challenge of the placement of the book.
Cheesham says the library's young readers section is close to the young adults section, so it was easy for a person younger than the book was intended for to stumble on it. The committee met on the issue last week. Cheesham says a number of people showed up at the meeting ready to, in his words, politicize the meeting, but were turned away because it was not an advertised public meeting.
When it became clear that that wasn't the kind of meeting it was going to be, and they left, we had a really really kind of an inspiring discussion, just because it was so open and honest and just the kind of discussions you'd like to have when the politics were sort of taken away. But I wish the people who are politicizing it would just kind of wait a little bit more patiently for the results to be made public.
At the Wasilla City Council meeting this week, several residents spoke out against the book and its place on library shelves. Although the issue was not on the agenda, the furor may be short-lived. Campbell is not asking the library to ban the book, Cheesham says, just to move it to another section. And he says the committee has some ideas in mind that people may like, although the decision won't be out until next week. Wasilla librarian Martin Albright did not return calls for comment on this story. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester, or at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
At its meeting last night, the Anchorage Assembly approved the city's 2016 budget, which totals just under $481 million. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
As far as budgets go, this one's route to passage the last few weeks has been blissfully uneventful, relatively speaking. The overall number is down just over $2 million from what was finalized last year. Beneath that decrease, though, is a dispute over whether money has actually been saved. With less revenue coming in, the city is maintaining services and even boosting the budget for public safety, in part through collecting more taxes. They also reduced the size of the operating budget through measures like shifting expenses to the capital budget or restructuring long-term financial obligations. Ultimately, the four conservative assembly members representing communities in Chugiak, Eagle River, and South Anchorage voted against the budget. Assemblymember Amy Domboski proposed 40 amendments, some that would result in savings as low as $285, which she says are part of a larger effort to delete unnecessary government expenses.
Through the process, just in scrubbing the budget, I think I found about $850,000 worth of savings we could have just achieved tonight.
but all those amendments were voted down by the body. During comments, most assembly members expressed that in worsening fiscal times, it was a decent enough first budget from the Berkowitz administration and one they could live with. The operating budget comes back up for review in April. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The annual run of lamprey is headed up the Yukon River. As KIYU's Tim Bodoni reports, diverse commercial markets for the snake-like creature have opened up over the past few years, but actually catching them can be tricky.
To catch a Yukon River lamprey, you need good, solid river ice and perfect timing. For almost 15 years, Quipuc Fisheries has tried to operate a commercial lamprey fishery on the lower Yukon sometime around Thanksgiving. But General Manager Jack Schulteis says, more than other fisheries, this one is hit or miss.
It's not a run that, like salmon, that goes on for days or weeks. The lamprey run goes on for basically hours, and then that's it.
Lamprey swim upriver to spawn, but unlike salmon, lamprey bunch together in one big horde as they move upriver and run under the cover of ice. Fishermen at Mountain Village started the commercial lamprey harvest this year on November 17th when a few thousand pounds of lamprey were taken. That harvest was curtailed by a lack of adequate river ice to give fishermen access to the main channel, according to Schulteis. Quipuc is expecting a stronger harvest of lamprey from the village of Grayling sometime in the next few days. The unpredictable nature of the lamprey harvest makes it hard to commercialize, according to Schulteis, because buyers want a steady supply year after year. Nevertheless, Yukon River lamprey gets shipped far and wide for a variety of purposes.
Some of them go to Europe, some of them go to Asia, and some of them go into the bait market in the lower 48. And that's all hinges on how much volume we get. When we get a lot of lamprey, then it's feasible to ship overseas. That's 20,000-pound increments of them. It's got to be a really good year to get that kind of volume.
By those standards, 2014 was a very good year, with just over 40,000 pounds of lamprey sold commercially. The parasitic creatures are typically caught with long-handled dip nets or impaled on long poles fixed with spikes. Lamprey also have a long history of subsistence use in certain villages, where they're commonly referred to as eels. Nearly half of their mass is fat, making them a good high-energy food for sled dogs. As human food, they're often smoked and jarred, and their skins can be used to make bags or even parkas. In Galena, I'm Tim Bodoni.
Alaska's capital city is battling addiction. The Juneau community continues to face substance-related deaths and near deaths. Three women who've been on that dark side recently went to KTOO to talk about addiction, long-term recovery, and a rally that gave them hope. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Christina Love, Kara Nelson, and Julie Douglas are all in recovery. At different times in their lives, they've been addicted to different substances. Love is an advocate at the Aware Shelter in Juneau. She says addiction started out with Adderall in college. Then it was cocaine.
And then we went to crack cocaine, and alcohol was always there. The hangovers were bad, so we went to pills, and then we went to oxys, and then we went to heroin, and then benzos. You mix in, I mean, it was really, it's anything that's in front of you at any given point.
Love detoxed in Fairbanks and became sober. Then she started treatment and is in long-term recovery.
Once you have this disease, you suffer it for the rest of your life, and it can't be stopped, but it can be arrested.
Love and Kara Nelson met on the recovery journey about 4 years ago. They'd been anonymous in meetings held in churches and basements before they started speaking and advocating publicly. Last month, they and six other women from Juneau and Anchorage represented Alaska in the Unite to Face Addiction rally in Washington, D.C. They marched in the National Mall with close to 30,000 people involved in the recovery movement, including other recovering addicts and those who've lost people to addiction. Nelson is the director of Haven House, a faith-based transitional home for women recently paroled or released from prison. Haven House provides peer-to-peer support for women who faced addiction and incarceration. Nelson organized the trip to D.C.
As a person in long-term recovery and as someone who has an extensive history in our criminal justice system and continuously sees my friends, our neighbors, our people incarcerated, and then the effects of that, and then getting out and having even more issues than being in prison itself. This was a very personal thing for myself to be a part of.
The rally called for changing the conversation around addiction and treating it as a health crisis. Nelson says recovery is a lifelong journey, not aftercare for a month.
If you have any other kind of illness or disease, you're going to have these checkups and you're going to continuously be checking into every symptom, right? That's exactly how substance use and mental health should be treated as well.
At one of the rally events, people wore T-shirts and carried posters of loved ones who had passed away from addiction. Julie Douglas says being surrounded by that helped her and the others come to terms with the wreckage of their past.
Any one of us could have been a poster or a T-shirt, for sure.
Douglas also works at Haven House as a house manager. She says offering peer support to the residents gives her support to heal from her alcohol addiction. During the rally, the group visited Alaska's congressional delegation to lobby for bills related to the recovery movement, like the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. The CARA bill will help bring money to grassroots recovery organizations. Love says it was empowering to be at the D.C. rally and be advocating with people who've shared experiences of feeling rejected, discriminated against, and suicidal.
I've said a million times over and over and over, I'm a person in long-term recovery. I mean, that's one of my favorite things about myself, and it's one of my favorite things about the people that I help, you know, because it stands for something so completely opposite from what the rest of the world thinks. You know, they see an addict, but I see a person who's resilient and a fighter.
Nelson helped form the Juno Recovery Community 2 years ago. It's people in recovery helping people in recovery through support and social events like Recovery Fest. But she says more needs to be done. Because Nelson and the others have the firsthand knowledge, it's personal. And
we've been able to educate ourselves to really be in a position where we are the ones that are the solution.
Nelson and Love are both recovery coaches. They plan to work with local agencies to form a community plan focused on recovery and are actively meeting with Juno organizations to try to establish a detox facility. In Juno, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Waldholtz, Ellen Lockyer, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, and Tim Bodoni in Galena. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. BP Alaska, as part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood when dining out or in. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.